Salama, thank you, and welcome to Juno Afternoon. I'm Boston Christopher. Today, we chat with Edward K. Thomas, President Emeritus of the Tlingit and Haida Central Council. His autobiography is titled My Moment in Time, Tempering Tribal Leadership with Life's Experiences. He will be at Hearthside Books on First Friday downtown for a book signing. And speaking of First Friday, we'll chat with Riley Jensen about her event happening at Kindred Post. Riley is a wildlife photographer working toward giving back via conservation efforts through her imagery. And we have a story from KTOO's Yvonne Crumrie on this year's featured artist at the Folk Festival, Willie Carlisle. Those conversations are coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon from your community-supported public media station, KTOO. You can also catch us on our live stream on KTOO's YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram pages. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Emil Mackey at Country Financial, offering insurance for home, auto, and business, and life insurance to protect your family in case of death. Located in the Juno Nugget Mall. More information can be found online or by calling 907-500-7017.
Hanson Gress, ka eat with the shoe ye, we ka shook a ye tin. Jin kat ka ke jin tau khanakhaya ha ani kakh gunish cheesh.
You're listening to KTOO's Tlingit Word of the Week. This week's word comes from Keishi Bessie Cooley. And the word this week is Janwu.
Janwu.
That means mountain goat. And here is a sentence.
Akuhini yech yan de kuhu. Janwu du teen nich. Weshakade.
When boating on the Taku River, people always see mountain goats on the mountains. Let's hear it again.
Jungwood.
Mountain goat. Gunish cheese to Hune Lance Twitchell, Gulbalt Heritage Foundation, and the University of Alaska Southeast for this audio.
Ke Yishi Bessie Cooley is Koketan and a child of a Yenyedi man. She is from Daisleen, Teslin, and grew up spending time in Teslin and around Teslin Lake. She earned a master's degree in Indigenous Languages and Linguistics from Simon Fraser University and interviewed many speakers for the Hashagun language series.
And tune in next week for another Tlingit Word of the Week from KTOO.
You are listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. You can also join us on our live stream on KTOO's YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram pages. I'm your host, Boston Christopher, and I'm honored to welcome to the studio now Edward K. Thomas. He is President Emeritus of the Central Council, Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska, where he garnered 27 years of service. His autobiography is filled with stories and memories from his time growing up in Craig, where he was one of four students in the graduating high school class, his time as a commercial fisherman, and his work in Ketchikan as Director of Indian Education and then president of the Ketchikan Indian Corporation, to, of course, his almost three decades as president of Tlingit and Haida. He is renowned for his work in management, leadership, and policy, having worked on initiatives and efforts at the local, state, and national level. He will be signing his autobiography, My Moment in Time, Tempering Tribal Leadership with Life's Experiences, tomorrow, March 6th, during First Friday, at Hearthside Books downtown from 4:30 to 7 p.m. You can also go to his website, edwardkthomas.com. Gunath Cheesh, Ha'yigudi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you in the studio, Edward. Wasiati, how are you today?
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. So I just want to jump right into this book. What gave you the idea, where was the impetus to, like, I want to write all these things down?
Well, it actually began trying to update the history of Tlingit Haida.
Ah.
Before I retired in 2014, I made a pledge to myself to work a little bit upon the historical document that the tribe has and update it. And what happened is I got online to try to find even Andrew Hope, who the building is named after over down the street, and I couldn't find anything on the web. And so I started wondering about other tribal leaders, and I checked around and not very much on any of them. Of course, there's a few on some people like Byron Malott or Dr. William Demert, but so many of the people who have done great things in our past for the Native community, there was nothing on it. So I began compiling profiles of these former leaders, and I thought that went very well. I put together a book called Tlingit Haida Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was kind of the beginning of it. As I retired, then I went down to where I live now in Kingston, Washington. And a friend of mine contacted me one day and said, I'm doing my thesis on you. I said, well, what do you mean on me? She said, I'm doing your history from when you were in Craig until you came down here. I said, well, that's really kind of interesting. I never thought about that as a thesis.
Mm.
She sent me the draft of what she wrote, and that really was kind of the framework for what ended up in the book. Her name was Karen Elliott, and she went out and did her paper on me, and I was really flattered, number one. Number two, it was kind of motivating for me to do something myself. Of course, you know what happens when you do something about yourself. It's considered bragging or overdoing it. And I thought seriously about that. But then I got a call from Richard Peterson, mm-hmm. current president, and he said, I want you to look at the book put forth by David Boxley.
Mm.
Because I think we should do one on you like that. And I looked at what he did, and it was very well done. Matter of fact, I'd say excellent. But, of course, he's an artist, and so he kept a lot of his artwork and that sort of thing in there. But I found in reading that he also talked about the revitalization of the Tsimshian culture.
Mm.
And that struck a bell with me. I think that during my period of time, we start revitalizing tribal governments, starting in Ketchikan and then some of the other communities and that sort of thing. And I felt some of that really needed to be written down. Mm. And, of course, I kept thinking about it. How am I going to, do all that stuff and still cover what I needed to do on the history of Tlingit Haida.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's really interesting because, like, you in the book, I mean, you definitely talk about your personal experiences, and then you also talk about the history of Tlingit Haida and the organization and all the things that happened at the end of the book. There's like a timeline where you document every sort of thing. And it's really interesting because I know sort of the idea of culturally, not wanting to brag, right? Not wanting to sort of be bigger than your britches. But it's also interesting that you said, but when you go to find something, you can't find anything on people. So there is like a reason, right, to document, to put down on paper, to have for future generations, not only the history of like actually what happened, but the people and like you talking about yourself and telling those stories is, to me, is not bragging. It's inspirational, right? Because you have had such a varied like life, from everything from commercial fishermen to being in education to talking about your mom and how important education is to, and then to your work as a leader and all the things that you've learned. So I'm curious to go back just a little bit. When you were reflecting on like your time as a boy in Craig, and you talk about, being one of four people to graduate from your high school, that's a small class. What was that experience like to sort of go back and remember those times for you?
Well, it was really refreshing for me to really think about all the good things that happen, even when you come from a family that is not well off, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You have friends, you have activities that bring people together, and to think about some of those things, while I can still remember, it was really motivating for me to keep going on and try to remember more about my time, not only in Craig, but as a fisherman. As I mentioned in the book, my biggest ambition was to be a crew member on a seine boat, mm-hmm. because that's what Craig was when I was a child. There was many seine boats and the cannery, two canneries functioning and that kind of life. And so we went down and saw people coming in, guys in the community, meeting their families, and just enjoying their experience in time, and then running right back out and going fishing again.
I love it that in the book you also have a chapter, it's chapter 13, Life Lessons Learned, and you're mentioning these seine boats right now, and because I was curious about the idea of like what from your experience as a younger person influenced your experiences, you know, later as a leader and things like that. But I just found this one funny as you were talking now, because that was your, you know, sort of wanted to do that as your work. But then you say, I found that a crew member on a fishing boat could not earn enough money to live on for the rest of the year. Did that sort of dash that dream of wanting to be a fisherman on a seine boat?
Well, not totally.
Yeah.
Because I then moved into becoming a skipper, and so I purchased my own net. And in the fishing industry, particularly seining, you get a credit for owning that net, as well as your own another half share for being the skipper.
I see.
So that brought it up to where you could make a living fishing and hang on for the rest of the year. But living in Craig, you know, trying to do things productive just didn't work for me. And I tried going to Ketchikan, and nothing was made available. Worked in the pulp mill a couple of years there and in the winter months. But it didn't really satisfy my need to, you know, keep busy and do more.
Yeah, and you sort of transition, because you start talking a little bit about your mom and how important education and the importance that education, that she instilled in you, how important to have an education is. And then you started working in education. So how did that transition happen? How did you start working in education?
As you mentioned, Mom was really, you know, hell-bent to get us good education.
Yeah.
And
good
Craig,
moms,
was,
right?
Yeah. And Craig, that was not as easy as it sounds, because many of the courses that were taught in the village at that time were not taught in schools like here in Juneau or in Sheldon Jackson. For example, I wanted to go on and do more in the science area, but we didn't have trigonometry in high school in Craig. We had basic algebra, which was way outdated, as I found out when I went into junior college. But what happened is after I got my associate's degree at Sheldon Jackson, I went home and it didn't do me much good to have that associate's degree. And I was back to fishing. And in 1968, I made up my mind I'm going to change the scene. I was getting ready to go to Seattle along with all the other fishermen on the same boats. And I was set to go down on a boat. And I was invited to dinner up at my best friend Archie Demert's house, and we just finished having dinner, and in walks Dr. William Demert, who was at that time superintendent of schools in Klawock, the neighboring community. And he asked Margaret Demert, who is the head of the household, could you come up and teach a couple weeks while we go out and search for a new teacher, because the teacher that we hired up and left without any warning. And Margaret thought for a minute and says, I just really can't do it. I've got things happening. I'm going to town for some medical, and you know, going to town meant going to Ketchikan. And as she finished, she said, God, why don't you just ask Ed? He's sitting here. You can ask him, and he'll do it. And that caught me totally by surprise.
Mm-hmm.
But I accepted. I went up there, and I had no lesson plan. I had no idea what books were going to be, and school started the next day.
Oh, wow.
And so Bill gave me the books, and he had taken the liberty of writing out a few lesson plans to get started for me, because he knew that whoever came would have to, you know, have a plan.
Jump in right away, yeah. Wow.
So he knew that, and to his credit, he wrote out a lesson plan, and all I did is go through it. And, of course, there's a lot of introductory on that first day. Here's what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the books, all those things.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a little bit easier getting started.
Mm.
But it wasn't for Dr. Demert, I really would have had a hard time because he nurtured me, you know, through that first month. And he said, well, I decided we're not going to advertise for a new teacher. I think you're doing pretty well. And
wow.
I'll help you along with Nora, which is his wife. And I think you're doing just well.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing. And then at some point you transitioned from, I know there was some other stuff in there too, but then like you ended up working as the president for the Ketchikan Indian Corporation, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's a little bit down the line because what happened to me is I was motivated by Dr. Demert and other teachers in Klawak to go back and get my degree. My bachelor degree. So I went up to University of Alaska Fairbanks and attended classes up there. And since I had 2 years already taken care of, I thought, I went up there. I thought, oh, in a couple of years, I'll be able to get my degree.
Yeah.
Didn't happen that way.
Never does, right?
No, because Sheldon Jackson was a parochial type school, and a lot of the credits that I earned there did not transfer into the university system, so I had to go another year.
Okay. So you ended up doing like three more years?
Yeah, three total years
up at Fairbanks.
Fairbanks to get my degree. And as you see in the book, some of that was even very, you know, challenging to get my degree. But what happened is when I went back to Craig as a counselor, the school hired me as a counselor, about beginning of the second half of the year, I got a call from Pat Gardner, who was a friend of mine, and he was at Penn State, and said, we're recruiting for people who want to get a degree, you know, a master's degree or a doctorate, and it's a full fellowship program. So I went and got through that program, and as I got out, I couldn't find a job right away.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, I'm just going to look further outside of the Craig Klawak area. I applied to Sitka. And there was the opening in the Indian Education Program as a counselor.
Mm-hmm.
So I got involved with that program and served as a counselor and advisor to that program. And lo and behold, an opening came available in Ketchikan for that program, the Indian Education Director Program.
Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't have much thoughts that I'd get it. And within a couple of weeks, I got a call and said, we'd like to interview you.
That's nice.
And then so I got ready to go down. And the superintendent said, well, it's not really an interview to see if you're going to get it. It's an interview to see if you're willing to come to Ketchikan, because the parent committee had decided that I was going to be, you know, the head of that Indian education program.
You were the one they wanted already.
They had met, and they had some applicants, and some of those folks who were not willing to transfer to Ketchikan, the ones that were on the top of the list.
And you'd already been in Ketchikan, and you loved it there.
I spent several years there.
Yeah.
You know, like in the pulp mill and whatever.
Right.
Well, quickly moving on, as I worked there for a couple of years, I noticed that other Indian education programs in other communities had also the Johnson O'Malley program that they used to work with Native students.
Mm.
And I asked the school district, I said, how come we don't have one? I said, oh, it's run by Alaska Federation of Natives through Tlingit Haida Central Council to come and do some advising on where kids can go to school, go to college after high school, which was just a very, very small component of the the Johnson Mallee program that other communities had.
Yeah.
So when I asked Tlingit Haida, can we take over that program locally, they declined. And it just so happened that the Indian Education Self-Determination Act was passed, and I went up to Anchorage to hear what that was all about and found out, there are IRAs in Alaska, and they will be the eligible tribal governments to be able to apply for and receive federal grants and contracts. So I applied, and we got it. We were one of the first in Alaska to get the grant that is for the planning of the contract, and
awesome.
We were also the first to get the contract. And that's because I had an assistant named Mary Jones, who if I told her what we were looking at, she read what was needed, put it all together, and there it was. So anyway, that's how we revitalized the Ketchikan Indian Corporation, which later became a Ketchikan Indian community.
Okay. I see.
And I was elected president probably because of what I did.
Yeah.
But I felt that we needed to have a separation, so the last couple years there, I stepped aside and had someone else be president, and I'd just be the executive director.
I see. Okay.
Until I got elected as president of Tlingit Haida.
Yeah, I want to move to that, the president of Tlingit Haida. That was in, was that 1984?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and I'm really curious about, after almost three decades, I know you retired and then they pulled you back in for a few years and then you re-retired. And, speaking of named buildings, you have a building now, a couple now, but the one down here on 410 Willoughby, I believe, was recently with your name on it, which is awesome, and congratulations on that. Really cool. But I'm curious in terms of what was Tlingit Haida like when you first got there, and what did you envision at that time for its future?
I thought that Tlingit Haida had a lot of potential because they, number one, situated here in Juneau, where the government was functioning out of at that time. And there was potential to do things in the communities if they worked with the community. I felt that there was not enough relationship building between what was happening here in Juneau and what was happening out in the villages. On top of that, I was a delegate to Tlingit Haida for a number of years, and I served on the finance committee, and we were spending, $400,000 more per year than what we brought in as income. And that was mostly my primary motivation to come and control those expenditures so that the tribe can keep moving on. And I thought that that if we controlled our costs and lived within the income, we can then start being eligible for new types of funding, and we can do better things for the people in the communities.
I see. You're listening to Juneau Afternoon on KTOO. I have the pleasure of speaking with Edward K. Thomas, President Emeritus of the Tlingit Haida Central Council. His new biography is titled My Moment in Time, Tempering Tribal Leadership with Life's Experiences. He's going to be at Hearthside Books downtown tomorrow from 4:30 to 7, signing copies of this wonderful book. And I do want to mention that he's got a website, edwardkthomas.com. And what's beautiful about this website is that you have on this website basically all of the pictures and even maybe even more of the pictures than are in the book. Like there's your early life in Craig, there's fishing years, there's a marriage and family, Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood, political meetings and representation, the culture, so many pictures that you have on this website. And it almost is like you don't even need the words almost. It's sort of like a story in pictures, which is also just beautiful that you have those pictures available. So definitely go check out EdwardKThomas.com. You can also see on there the book and get yourself a copy of it. But you can also buy it locally, which is also nice. Buy it from Hearthside. Support your local bookstores. I do want to ask you before we have to depart, Edward. I could talk to you for hours about your life. It's amazing. You have the subtitle of this book is so interesting to me: Tempering Tribal Leadership with Life's Experiences. Tell me about that subtitle and why you came to that.
I think that in my experience, I felt that I was able to do a better job at what I was elected to do by thinking back on the problems that people are facing in the communities, things that I went through. You know, you can look at them as problems, but they were learning experiences. And I think that building of that character through those experiences really give you a little bit more temperament to do what is necessary for running a tribal government.
I see. Okay. And one of my favorite sections of the book is the life lessons learned at the end. I also love the listing of all the things over the Tlingit and Haida, you know, history, all the different highlights and the things that were accomplished during your time and outside of your time, and all the things that were done there. The growth of Tlingit and Haida over your period of time was amazing. One of the things I did want to ask about under lessons from culture, and it's interesting, there's some great ones in here, but you say an elder was not an elder just by getting old. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that so often people will bring the two together, but an elder in the society of the Tlingit is one that does some things that are significant or there to be supportive and the learning and teaching the next generation. So you become elder with some wisdom, not just by age.
Wisdom, yeah, that's the one. And under leadership, there's one you say here, a leader must have the character to achieve effectiveness. I mean, these are just fantastic morsels that people can pick up from this book. Not only that, plus all of the history and the photos and your personal journey. It's fantastic to hear that story, because a lot of times you see a person in a leadership position and you forget about that we all come from humble beginnings, right? We all come from, you know, being young and dumb, you know, and like trying to figure life out. And you also go into, we didn't talk about it today here on the show, but you go into marriage and family and all of that that was sort of making up your life and the lessons you learned from that and how those then can be applied to your work and back and forth. And so I guess my last question for you is, what do you hope for the future of Tlingit and Haida, or for tribes in Southeast, or for the world in general? What do you hope for the future?
I hope that not just for the Tlingit and Haida as an organization, but the Native community, that we can continue to inform the next generation of what people had to go through in order to have what we have today and be more respectful. And also, you know, in the culture, to participate and not just be there, but you got to learn what they're doing and pass some of those traits on or practices on to the next generation.
Yeah, it's always about the next generation and uplifting them, making sure that they're taking
and
part.
And the reverse of that is I hope that more and more of the next generation embraces the people that we would determine elders and their advisors or mentors and learn more from them, instead of so many of families push the older people aside or take advantage of them rather than try to learn and embrace their presence in your community.
That is such a good lesson, right? Like, listen to your elders. You can learn a lot if you just listen. Yeah, that's pretty amazing. Edward K. Thomas, Gunth Cheese, for being here. I really appreciate it. His new book, he's going to be signing My Moment in Time, Tempering Tribal Leadership with Life's Experiences, tomorrow during First Friday, March 6th at Hearthside Books downtown from 4:30 to 7 p.m. I really appreciate your time today, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gunth Cheese.
Can I say I was the only Tlingit to ride down Pennsylvania Avenue
on
a horse during the Clinton inauguration?
Absolutely.
That's a little brag there.
I love that. I love a little bit of brag. I love it. That's a good one. That's a good brag right there. You're listening to Juno Afternoon from KTOO. I'm Boston Christopher. Now we're going to listen to a story about folk singer and songwriter Willie Carlisle. He's this year's guest artist at the Alaska Folk Festival in April. He's from Kansas and has spent his career in and around the Ozark Mountains learning folk traditions and reimagining them. KTOO's Yvonne Crumry spoke with Carlisle about what makes the Folk Fest special.
Them coals are turning bright red, firewood's in the truck bed, river's running low this time of year.
And you were in Juneau for Alaska Folk Fest in 2019. What drew you to apply to do that and to come up and perform?
I ran into the Alaskans at the Folk Alliance conference. They were so rowdy and welcoming. It just felt like the stars aligned and I could make it to this amazing community event. By community events, I mean like most of the people are just there to share with each other. And that's a model for a folk festival that I kind of think that the rest of the world could learn something from.
In your song, Your Heart's a Big Tent, there's a line that has become popular with your fans. Just sing until you love yourself, love until you die.
My conclusion's not a great one. I'll leave that to the smarter ones. The soul is an idiot. It doesn't care why. Whatever you do with it, the gift's a pretty simple one. Just sing until you love yourself and love until you die.
And so much of, like you said, this festival is made up of everyday Alaskans who just want to get on stage and sing. What does that do for people?
Music and community, oral traditions, collective rituals perpetuate these connected ecosystems that can provide meaningful alternatives to late capitalism's apocalyptic end run. I don't think that folk music or something like that is literally the thing that saves the whales, saves the world, saves anything. But I do believe that that kind of connectivity, when done open-heartedly and for community first, provides something meaningfully different than being a subject to whatever is next on TV, to being a subject to whatever is being forced down our throats by advertising.
And so I'm wondering, like, what is it like for you to come back to Juneau for Folk Fest after 7 years? And I know things have probably changed for you in your life. And what does that mean to you?
Boy, for one thing, it's just a dream come true. The idea that I can come back in this capacity is a little overwhelming and something I want to do right by. It has been an honor to experience growing through word of mouth. But I'll say this, that at festivals around the country, I sometimes experience very little folklore, but instead like a sense of celebrity. I want to try to take opportunities like the Alaska Folk Festival to like break the mold a little bit, to be a part of reigniting folk music's like activistic edge, but also to just stay a perpetual learner and to stay curious, because I'll admit right now that I'm intimidated by the level of picking that I heard, at the very least. I've got some things to learn from guitar players and banjo players and fiddle players all over, you know, too.
On your newest album, there are some old school sounding folk and country songs about people who don't often make it into those kind of stories, like Big Butt Billy.
Well, good God almighty, hell, Satan. I've never seen a finer they them than Big Butt Billy.
What do you think of expanding the cast of characters in the genres you work in?
I could have a career where I could just try to pass as straight and someone who did not care, but that would feel so horribly dishonest that it would really be me harming myself. And I've already done that, and I'm not interested in it. And frankly, I don't understand how artists are not vocal about things. I don't understand how they get up in the morning, and I don't have a lot in common with them.
In an interview, you said a folk singer should be a dreamer with a long memory. And I'm wondering, how do you think the moments that we're living through right now are adding to that long memory and influencing your music?
I think that folk music is a part of acknowledging, and not just acknowledging, but performing the dialectical materials of the people that have struggled to get us where we are today. Right. I don't just mean strictly protest music. I mean, your grandmother singing a little song while she's washing the dishes is a part of the history of that, like, unacknowledged, unaccounted for work that we can acknowledge by living traditions in our bodies with each other. When I say a dreamer with a long memory, what I mean is a dream deep enough to be compassionate to people that are no longer here, to listen to the ghostly voices that labored, worked, procreated, you know, loved, hated, and scrubbed and toiled to get us here, but also to have a memory long enough to attach those dreams to reality, to our current lived scenario.
Yeah, they say the pay is prime time, much better than a cop. Surely better than a teacher in the cities where they stomp on the necks of those who came here with a prayer or with a dream, than those that seek asylum from unjust regimes. They'll terrorize our cities till we stand right where she stood. History will tell the story. They were evil, she was good.
Do you have any advice for musicians who are just starting out and trying to find their voice in folk music?
If you want to get started in folk music, be an almanac, not an encyclopedia. You're reading the palm of the past. To use archives, but don't get trapped in them. To study and practice, but don't become confined to a single style or a single idea. So I guess my advice would be really bring it to people. Share it with people. Use it to make something that helps people feel good and feel connected. The other stuff is just fun. And lean into the fun part, but don't let it eat you.
What are you hoping to give to and receive from an audience these days?
Well, let's see. I guess I like it when an audience sings and dances. I really do. I want that to be a part of pretty much everything. So towards that end, we're going to do some dancing. We're going to do some singing. What do I expect from them? It's just the same thing. I'm already getting so much just by the being there, honestly. If I can show up and do my job well, I'd like for it to be a good value for the organizers. I really mean that. As soon as Cheddar is involved, I generally think, how do I make sure that anybody who collected and or spends the Cheddar gets their money's worth? I hope I get to absorb some great music, and I hope I get to shake some interesting hands. And it'd be great to stay up all night and play in the Alaskan. That'd be great.
The doctor asked me where it hurts, born to fish, forced to work. Don't let him tell you what your broken heart's worth. Fire ant on the sugar trail, tail feathers on a night.
That was folk singer Willie Carlisle speaking with KTOO's Yvonne Crumry. Carlisle is this year's Folk Festival guest artist, coming up here in less than a month, or just about a month. Pretty cool. You're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Tongass Federal Credit Union, a member-owned financial cooperative offering checking and savings accounts, loans, and digital financial services. In Juno at 8585 Old Dairy Road in the K Plaza and at TongassFCU.com. Federally insured by NCUA. You are listening to Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Riley Jensen, a wildlife photographer, joins me now in studio. Her work will be on display this first Friday at Kindred Post. She has studied brown bears in Alaska, and she also hopes, I saw on your website anyway, a hope to eventually work to help in the conservation efforts for animals around the globe with your photography and your imagery, which I think is really cool. But Riley joins me now. Thank you so much, Riley. It's a pleasure to meet you. How are you today?
Good. Thank you for having me here.
That's excellent. So you had, I want to start here, but you recently had visited Alaska. You've been studying brown bears in the summer, but you've now made your way permanently to Southeast and joined us in our lovely community of Juneau. When did that happen?
Yeah, the first time I ever stepped foot in Alaska was in 2019. I was in my senior year of college, and I saw this ad posted for Becoming an Outdoors Woman workshop. They can learn, like, archery and do sled dogging and stuff like that. So I just kind of signed up for it on a whim and then came up here and met some, you know, Alaskans who kind of showed me around Anchorage. And I was like, wow, this place is gorgeous. And they're like, you've actually arrived at the grossest time of year because it was March. But I had a great time. And I was like, I need to work up here someday, because I had been used to doing a lot of seasonal jobs at that point. So I started looking for more seasonal jobs in Alaska. And then that summer I ended up working in Katmai National Park as a bear park ranger, or like a bear technician. And then I just did that for 3 summers because I fell in love with it too.
What does a bear technician do?
I kind of describe it as like professional bear babysitting. So basically I would patrol camp. The camp is like a 1.5 mile square radius, and bears and fishermen and photographers and guests just kind of mingle with each other and weave in and out. So my job is to kind of try to establish some order and keep people away from bears, and in turn try to keep bears away from people, which is easier said than done sometimes. They're very habituated there, so we kind of came to like an understanding over the course of the
talking seasons. mind pathing with each other.
A lot of, you know, foot scuffing and clapping at them.
sure. And so then what led to you getting into photography? Has that always been a sort of a lifelong thing for you?
That's kind of just always I've carried that with me, like, throughout my life, like, all the jobs I've done. So I, you know, started off kind of amateur, just kind of carried a camera with me to just document what I was doing, taking pictures on trips. And then I think it was around that summer, or at least that's the summer before I came up here, that I started to get more serious about it, and then started upgrading my gear, and then started, you know, hearing that my photos were good, which was, you know, always nice to hear. So I just kind of delved into it a little deeper, and then really started like opening my own shop, and then taking intentional trips for photography, and then just kind of going on from there. Finding a community of other photographers and learning from them and learning how they sell prints and how they, you know, what gear works for other people. So it really just has kind of evolved into this whole, like, I guess still it's a side gig or like a side hobby, but I've devoted a lot of my life to it, and I take it a lot more seriously now.
Yes, it definitely becomes a lifestyle, right? Like, and you probably, I mean, I imagine that you see the world in some ways a little differently, like as you're out and about. And if you didn't have your camera, is there a time where you're like, oh man, I wish I had my camera right now? Because you're going to see an image or a picture that you would want to take, right? Like you would see the composition of that. And that's just so wild to me, because I just walk through life like, oh yeah, hello, there's the sun. Yeah, cool. There's a bear.
I think it's interesting because I've actually kind of started to think more about not having my camera places and like being more intentional about what pictures I actually take. Because in the beginning it was like, I'm just going to snap like photos of every scene I come across. And like every time there's something cool, I'm going to be taking photos and like experiencing it through my camera. But I've found that I remember things better, and I hold like better memories of encounters when my camera is not like in front of me. So I've kind of learned over the years when I want to take a picture and when I want to just enjoy the moment, and then kind of marrying those two to find a balance, basically.
That's fantastic. What got you into specifically wildlife photography? Was it something about animals that you've just always loved animals, or that as opposed to like pictures of people or whatever?
I mean, I've always been an animal kid. I grew up on like Steve Irwin and like Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom and Animal Planet and all of that. So like,
right.
That was never like a question in my mind that was going to be like what I really wanted to photograph. I actually find photographing people a little bit more challenging, because you can talk to people and like tell them what you want to do. And sometimes I'm not always sure of what I want people to do with their arms or their or posing. So I'm working on that. But I do like, you know, using photography as kind of a vehicle for seeing the world in a way, and just taking it with me when I do go to these wild places. It's kind of just a great way to help show people the world through my eyes in a way.
And I don't think I ever finished this, but when did you decide to come back to Juneau permanently?
I want to say this past October, well, a year ago now, October. I started dating my partner at that time, and he already lived up here, and it also coalesced with me finishing up my master's degree at the same time, and doing all of these seasonal jobs for the past 10 years, I was already starting to kind of feel that pang of, like, wanting community and wanting to be somewhere permanent, and I just thought, like, I've already been to Juneau, and I know I really love it here after working here for a summer, and I want to come back in some way, so I just thought, like, everything's kind of lining up for me to come back up here, and it just makes sense to me. So I did the big road trip up here in May, last May.
Last May. Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome. This is Juneau Afternoon. We're talking with Riley Jensen. She's a wildlife photographer. She's going to be at Kindred Post on First Friday tomorrow, March 6th. She's going to have her photos there. You can talk to her about her work. And I do want to ask, I want to show a couple photos for those who might be watching on the stream. But and one of these I'm going to show here is, I think this is a caribou that you saw on the road trip up. Is that right?
Yeah, I started seeing caribou kind of towards the northern border of British Columbia and the Yukon. And those were the animals that I really wanted to see most badly on this trip. I just think they're so quirky and funny, and they just represent, like, the north to me.
And this caribou is, like, looking right at you, too. Like, it's just, like, he's just going, like, what's going on? What are you doing?
Yeah. They kind of, like, circle you a little bit and just try to get a sense of what you're doing.
Like, what's happening? And there's some other great photos that you have. There's a photo of a wonderful photo of an eagle. There's a bear on a beach, which is really cool. That's a nice one. And I pulled you sent me a bunch of photos, and people are going to be able to see these in person tomorrow. And there's also this really cool one of the whale, coming out of the water here. How did you capture that photo?
So my first summer up here in 2022, I was doing kayak whale tours with Above and Beyond Alaska. Mm-hmm. And it was towards the end of the season, and a lot of the captains had told me about bubble net feeding, that behavior where all the whales kind of come together, and then they herd fish in a tight ball, and then they push them up towards the surface, and then they all come up and they eat at the same time, and they just, like, swallow big gulps of fish whole. So I had wanted to see that all summer, and then I think it was one of my last trips before I had to leave, and we caught up with a group of bubble net feeders, and I was, like, freaking out on the boat, just like, can you guys believe what we're seeing? And everybody was kind of just like, yeah, that's neat. It was, like, a little bit of an underwhelming
reaction.
Seen
them all.
I'm, like, on the verge of tears. Like, these whales.
Yeah, it's funny. That happens a lot with eagles, right? We get a lot of tourists who come to town, and they see all the eagles, and they're like, oh, my God, the eagles. And we're like, yeah, they're like pigeons around here sometimes.
That's what I tell people, too.
So what is the secret to taking a good outdoor wildlife photo?
I think having, like, seen a lot of other wildlife photographers, and, you know, inevitably you kind of compare your work to theirs. I think everybody just has different styles with how they photograph wildlife, and so I just try to get angles that I want people to see and kind of, like, tell a story about, too. So, like, the bear picture, for example, of the bear walking on the beach. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that's the one where it's kind of, like, low angle. Like,
yeah,
the beach
low angle. Looks like you're across the water on the other side there.
Yeah, so, like, that one I kind of wanted to highlight how bears rely on the sea and the land during the spring, especially. So I was getting, you know, a really low angle on the beach to highlight the bear walking across, but then show, you know, like, that balance between the coast and the water and the grass and sky. So in a way, kind of highlighting how bears, like, clam on the beach for clams, and then they go back to the sedge meadows for grass. And then, you know, it requires some more explanation instead of just looking at the picture. But I like a photo to kind of lead into a story in a way.
I see. Okay. Yeah. And is there specific, like, tools that you use or lenses, specific lenses that you have to use for capturing? Does it like slow down the world in some way? Tell me about, I guess I don't understand that. I want to know that a little bit more.
For wildlife photography specifically, you do need a good telephoto lens, and that's basically just a, you know, long angled lens, like that allows you to zoom in on subjects really closely. Mm-hmm. Because with wildlife, you're going to be far away. It's just kind of like the nature of it. And I try to photograph wildlife as ethically as I can too. So I don't want to, you know, disturb their natural behavior, kick them away from what they're doing. So I rely heavily on my telephoto lenses to get close to the subjects, I guess you could say, photographically.
Right.
So I now have a like 100 to 500 millimeter lens, which allows me to get as like pretty much what I want, like right up on the subject without actually walking up to them.
So you can be pretty far away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing. And you're speaking of that, like, not interrupting their habitat as much as possible to get these photos. And I mentioned that in the intro about sort of conservation efforts and thinking about that. How, when you have that idea, that dream of working on that, how does that work for you in terms of your photos and wanting to, is it bringing attention to certain aspects of animal life that then can be conserved? Or what are you thinking about doing with that?
You know, I'm still trying to figure out what exactly mm-hmm. I want to do with that, because some people have, you know, a style that's very photojournalistic. And so they're showing the human and wildlife side very well, and how people are doing research in the field, or, you know, like wildlife trafficking, and they're showing, you know, like animals in cages. And that's really like, it evokes a lot of emotion with people. And you think of like Nat Geo photographs.
Mm.
I think with my photography, I started off doing a lot of wildlife portraits, which is great. And it kind of helped me develop a lot of skills in photography specifically. And I think right now what I'm trying to do is just dispel a lot of like myths about wildlife, and particularly about bears. Like with there being so many bears here in Alaska, there's a lot of misinformation out there about how to, you know, behave around bears and what bears are actually like.
Mm.
So I hope that my photos kind of show their personalities in a way that brings people closer to them, and, you know, emotionally, so they can want to learn more about them and, you know, see that they're not like man-eating monsters. A couple years ago, actually, I was working for Natural Habitat Adventures, and during that summer, there was a big controversy about a mine out in Lake Clark National Park. And me being out there, like based out in Lake Clark National Park, I wanted to show people like what we would lose if this project were to happen to go through. And so I got really into bear photography that summer and trying to showcase like the bears that actually live in Lake Clark.
Mm.
So people could really see like tangibly what we would be losing with that.
I see. Yeah, that's amazing. So tomorrow at Kindred Post, you're going to be stationed at Kindred Post from 4:30 to 7.
Mm-hmm.
And what's going to be happening tomorrow?
I've got a table set up there. I've got 5x7 inch and 8x10 inch prints. And I'm just really happy to chat with people about my experiences, maybe help them find a photo that would look best in your home. So,
right.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about the stories behind a lot of my prints and, you know, just showing off what I have here and kind of asking people what they want to see and just kind of gauging interest here in Juneau. And hopefully I can do more markets in the future after this too.
I love that. Well, welcome to Juneau full time.
Thanks.
happy to have you here. And I hope that people can get out tomorrow for First Friday, stop by Kindred Post, check out Riley Jensen's photography. You can also go to her website, rileyjphoto.com. That's R-Y-L-E-E-J-A-Y, rileyjphoto.com. And you can see some information and some other photos that Riley has. What a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for coming in, Riley. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you as well.
Break a leg tomorrow.
Thanks.
This is Juneau Afternoon on KTOO. We're going to go out today listening to the new single from Taylor Dallas Vidic called Trash Birds. So I guess it has something to do with, a little bit to do with wildlife. Here's Trash Birds from Taylor Dallas Vidic. It's her new single off of her upcoming album, Cat and Mouse.
Mm-hmm. the street. Been 2 weeks since I've been sure of my feet, sure of my senses and the ways you look at me. That's why I'm leaving and I'm still.
Afternoon on tomorrow's show, Rhapsody in Blue, concert by the wind ensemble Taku Winds, and a weekend library talk titled Touchstones of Glaciers and Bears, Navigating a Changing Climate. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. Hello, out the road. Find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon, where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, offer feedback or suggestions, or find out how to be a guest on the show. You can also find live stream archives on KTOO's YouTube page. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Programming support for Juno Afternoon comes from listeners and viewers like you and Country Financial, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, Hanson Gress, and Tongass Federal Credit Union. Juno Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gunath Chee!